This is Counterculture with Marie Buskey, Wednesdays at 10 a.m. on Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome along and back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Oh, I'm excited about this conversation because it's been too long. It's been like almost 18 months. Danger Row, Free Speech Union board member, writer, producer, all about bloke about town in South Auckland. How are you?
I'm really good. It's great to be back here with you.
It is good to be back. It has been far too long. And what triggered it was actually a press release that you sent out recently about a satire and parody bill. That sort of perked my ears up, being somebody who is prone to write a little bit of satire from time to time. Tell us a little bit more about this. It's come from an area in a place that I didn't think it was going to come from. But like many things, there are so many things to consider.
Yes, well, it's a bill put forward by Kahurangi Kata, who is a relatively new Greens MP. This is a Green Party bill. What it's seeking to do is it's a copyright parody and satire amendment bill to protect artists and creatives and using satire and humour to get messages across, right? So it's all about that. Now, apparently, everyone, well, you know, other countries around the world have sort of made changes, or there are changes in place, and we're sort of lagging behind in the sphere. This bill seems to be us catching up to where other people are at with making parody and satire permissible, you know, without there being much consequence. I mean, you know, creatives weren't dropping like flies because of this bill. It's one of those, I think they were really just weeding the garden. I don't think it was really causing people. It probably de facto was in place, but now this bill just will make it official. But what's so fascinating about the bill is that all the language in it is about free expression is so important, you know, all of this stuff. And it's like, hello, where were you during the hate speech laws? And all the, I mean, the Greens are notoriously pro-censorship. And here they are, you know, with this bill, which, you know, God bless them for it, you know, using sentences in the bill like, all free expression is so important. So it's a little bit kind of laughable, really. But we're glad that you're taking strides in this direction, at least.
It just concerns me that you feel that they need to actually enshrine something in law to protect humour.
Yeah, I mean, I don't quite know what angle they would be coming at it from. I mean, it's a copyright bill, so I guess if you were doing a sketch and maybe imitating the structure of a show or a character or using a character's name and stuff like that, I guess you could be liable if someone was to really get a bee in their bonnet and had a lot of money.
Right, so it's sort of that fair use thing, isn't it? So it's sort of like throwing comedy and parody in that place where you use clips and stuff from a media or journalistic perspective. So sort of protecting that element of it, maybe.
Maybe. I don't know if it's the use of clips. If it's comedy and humor, it could be like the Jon Stewart type thing where you just have like a short clip and so forth. There's a lot of confusion about fair use itself. I know Pat Brittington with the Big Hairy News, you know, that Dunedin, he's a more of a left-wing commentator. He was streaming whole debates. And, of course, TVNZ shut him down. And he was like, fair use, but you can't stream an entire debate. Like, that's nuts, nuts. Like, I was on the board of the Writers Guild at the time, and, you know, fair use, they measure it down to the second. You know, it's pretty strict because this is people's IP and their livelihood. So you can't just take it. But in satire and humour, I think any cultural icon or any personality in culture, news, politics, it's got to be open to humor, to parody and satire because it isn't. I mean, some of the most effective advocacy is done with parody and satire. I think it's a tool that we should be using a lot more, even in politics. A lot of political campaigns are very, very serious. And I don't think you reach as many people as if you're having a laugh with others, you know, like if you're having, like, and I tell you who does it really well, and that's the Taxpayer Union. I don't agree with everything they do. I know Jordan, obviously he's on the advisory board of Free Speech Union as well. He's a lovely guy. Don't agree with all of his politics, but he has a lot of fun. You know, he uses a lot of humor and it reaches people. So I do welcome the bill if it's going to clean up something that may have been like loose threads or something like that attached to a law. But I don't think, like I said, creatives were dropping like flies because of copyright infringement here. But almost the biggest story for us is the hypocrisy or the chutzpah of the Greens, who were so pro-censorship, but now are pro-free speech when it matters to them.
It actually, as you've spoken, I'm just wondering whether they've actually put this in there as a way to protect memes.
It could be that. I mean, meme culture is, I mean, why would you, how do you censor some of this stuff now?
Yeah, well, exactly. But then also, too, you raised a really interesting question as well, is where does parody and satire cross over into hate speech and offence?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I remember in the 2016 election, when Trump first came to power, that's when the alt-right became, you know, very public. They were like the new kids on the block. And, you know, I'm Jewish, and a lot of their memes and a lot of the online content they had was pretty anti-Semitic. But it was, I got to give it to them, it was kind of funny. They were using humor to make their points. Now, they didn't like us, but they were trying to do it with it was a trolling culture, wasn't it? I think that's what you call it, the trolling culture. So, yeah, I mean, there are some very, it is very hard to work out the line there. And I mean, just like hate speech, it's very hard to work out the line. I mean, I suspect if I was to confront the Greens about this and say, hey, you were hypocritical because you were pro hate speech and everything, and what's this bill about? I am sure I could almost put money that they would say, oh, that's free speech. That's not hate speech. We support free speech. They try to make the distinction, and you really can't, because, I mean, again, where is the line? Who decides? All of these questions, which no one yet, and we've been having this debate for so long now, they still haven't been able to answer that for us.
I have to admit, I'm somewhat of a free speech absolutist, I have to say. I mean, because how do you police something? I mean, I guess there are simple things like you don't yell, what was it, fire in a crowded theatre or things like that to incite those sorts of fight and flight type reactions, which can be exceptionally dangerous. But how do you, from a speech perspective, how do you police a verbal boo-boo? And there's lots of verbal boo-boos that have been going on, and that perceived offence, the perception of offence has become so weaponized in the last several years. And you're right, you know, 2016, like you sort of brought up in regards to the alt-right. I mean, the alt-right now, funnily enough, fast forward to 2024, and this is depending on what your definition of alt-right is. There are a lot of people that now sit on particularly the what I would call Christian conservative side of right side of politics, which get labelled alt-right by anybody that, you know, the Overton window has left behind, that they're alt-right, but they've actually become incredibly supportive of issues like, for example, the war in the Middle East, and being very, you know, supportive of the Jewish cause as opposed to anti-Semitic. So it's incredible how these interesting little bedfellows start popping up with this movement around politics, especially over the last 8 years. I find it fascinating.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point I think you're getting at, and it's one that I think about deeply, is the misuse of language. And this is something that George Orwell would talk about too. I think it's a bigger issue than like censorship and things like that. If you're wanting to censor other people, you would think that those people would have a lot more care for language. Like, you know, calling people far right, for instance. Well, there's a few things that I think we need to break down to make this conversation sort of, you know, work really. And there are distinctions here. Like, we're talking about who are these people? So you've got the right and you've got the left. Now, my understanding of the right and left growing up in South Auckland in the mid-80s, you know, early 80s, is that they describe economic beliefs. Mm-hmm. So if you're on the left, you believe in redistribution of wealth, fair conditions for workers, all that kind of thing. You know, I mean, if you're on the far left back then would be like, no, privatization, you're not privatization, national
communism, full on communism, socialism, hardcore.
The worker owns collectively owns the company. You know, that would be the extreme. Mm-hmm. But it was still a economic question. And then the right would be pick yourself up from the bootstraps type characters and everything. And it's like, you know, if you work hard, you'll get ahead. If you don't, you won't, you know. So, and we can argue about, yeah, I don't think one side's right or wrong, to be honest with you. I think different circumstances prove both of them right and both of them wrong. The left of my youth in South Auckland were socially conservative. Like, they were social conservatives. I was brought up in an area that had a high percentage of Polynesian and Māori. The Māori were very conservative. Like, the Māori households then were very conservative, especially the Pacific Islanders, who were, you know, very Christian in the main. So there was social conservatism then. On the left, it was a socially conservative but economically pro-redistribution side of politics. Now, all of that means nothing today, really, because for people who call themselves like the organized left tend to view culture as the only real measure. You know, if you believe in a lot of core progressive ideas, they call them progressive, whether they are progressive or not. That's another term that I think gets misused a lot, because like censorship gets thrown in the progressive camp, and censorship has only ever been known as a regressive measure, not a progressive measure. So if we are to be precise, I see no good reason to say that the left wing shouldn't be or can't be or isn't still economically focused. You know, just because other people have bent what the meaning of the word doesn't mean I should go along with it, because Karl Marx wouldn't go along with it.
Well, but that's the delineation, though, between the current left political elite, which I believe actually work in a place of identitarianism, tribalism and collectivism. There's a totem of oppression and a power balance. So instead of working off an economic base and classism that you talked about, it's all about power. So you've got them who are currently in power and they love power and they lust for power. Yeah, for sure.
Sorry, let me just jump in while I have the thought in my head. What you just described to me, I would call, well, back then I would have called the far right. Mm-hmm. That to me is the far right. Identitarianism, not a focus on classism, hierarchies, you know, pointing the finger at certain groups and wanting to sort of advance above them. Like, that to me would be a far right agenda rather than a left wing agenda. So it's, and it's so important that we get these terms mm-hmm. correct. And I'd love to see more of an effort from people to correct people when they say, I'm a progressive. What do you believe? I believe in censorship. Well, that's not a progressive ideal. So mm-hmm. are you a progressive? We should be leaping on these things a bit more and just sort of cleaning this up. Because the far right, for instance, right, for me, you know, being Jewish and, you know, being an active member of the community, the real far right do pose a threat to me.
Mm. That's sort of like an Aryan styled one racial nation type
100%.
State. Yep.
100%. But if you're calling everyone far right, if you're calling conservative Christians who would probably go out of their way to help a person like me far right, then it actually exasperates the security situation for communities like myself, like my own and the Muslim community, because if everyone's far right, it's very easy for the real far right to go under the radar.
Absolutely. Welcome to the culture war, Dane, that I've been living in for the last 6 years, because this is what's been going on. This has come out of academia and they've gone and done this incredible political sleight of hand. There are so many people who I think, particularly people that live in the middle, they live in that actual sort of classical liberal space where, and I think you described it beautifully earlier on, where they may have quite community-focused social ideals on one hand, but be very socially or have religious or conservative leanings in the other. So they sort of sit in that middle ground. But in that middle ground, you've got the ability to talk and discuss and, you know, and be part of a fabric of society. Mm. And whilst everybody was living in the real world, as I like to call it, working and living in their communities, there's been an overlay which has come out of academia, specifically come out of academia, that in a way by stealth and by a sleight of hand of using some very clever language, all of a sudden have been in positions of power. And you, that's when you find yourself like in this really crazy place where you've got parties like the Green Party and Te Pāti Māori that consider themselves very much on the left side or progressive side of politics. But when you actually break it down to its nuts and bolts, it's anything but.
No, that, I wouldn't call either of those parties progressive. I think they have some progressive, that they may have some progressive policies in there, but on the main, I would call them more, they're just statist, really. It's statism, you know. Mm. And it's quite interesting because, like, fascism and communism, when you push them to their extremes, really resemble each other because they're statist. It's the state being everywhere. I know a lot of people like to say, oh, Hitler was on the left, and you know that troll, you know, where how people say that. Well, I like to think about Stalin was probably on the right, really. He was very staunchly nationalistic. When he died, he was about to start a whole lot of pogroms against Jews. He'd been doing that. There had been pogroms against Jews under Stalin. So both sides sort of start, when you get right to the fringes like that, they start to sort of resemble each other. And I think with a lot of the debate, a lot of the protests against Israel at the moment, you will see the real far right marching with very conservative Muslims and the far left. They're all on the same page here. So why? Because they're more on that sort of fringe end. But coming back to the whole thing of misuse of language, you wouldn't misuse the term far right if it threatened you. You wouldn't have the luxury to do that. You know, you'd be a lot more cautious. So that's a tell as well. I think a lot of people who are throwing these names around are doing it not thinking of consequence, because it's a frivolous act for them. It's very easy to do. I just can't do it. I just can't point at people and say that. You know, I can't just point to anyone I disagree with and say that. It's got to be rooted in something real.
Mm. And also, this is where comedy and parody, like, let's take the bill off the table, but comedy and parody, and you're a comedy writer, has been one of the most incredibly effective mechanisms to be able to break down walls and barriers between social and or racial or ethnic groups to bring everybody together.
Yes.
That's why I do worry a little bit about any form of legislation on any form of speech like that, because if you have people second guessing what they can say in terms of having some fun banter or discussion or just humanity with somebody else, with this overarching fear of, am I going to be creating offence with that person? Well, then that just puts up invisible walls, doesn't it? And you actually want to be breaking walls down, not putting walls up.
Well, something very interesting has happened recently, which was completely predictable. I predicted it. And it's not because I'm this amazing intellect or soothsayer or anything like that. It's because it's happened before. It happened in the 1980s. You know, we had a conservative president in the States. The evangelical movement, I don't know how much power it had, but if they felt they had a lot of power, there was, you know, Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority were prominent in the news. And while that was happening, we had Sam Kinison, Andrew Dice Clay, and a whole era of shock comedians. In liberal societies, democracies like our own, there will always be an answer to attempts to censor. People don't really just put down their weapons and walk away. You know, like, that's not really what happens. You create your opposite. I mean, that often happens in politics, you know. Look, that's what we're seeing, I guess, maybe with the treaty bill, you know, like the Labour had designs that it wanted to push through and they sort of created their opposite in David Seymour. You know, he leapt on something. They're probably both being cynical about it, to be fair. But that's what happens. You create your opposite. And, you know, Joe Rogan was platforming a lot of, right through this woke era, he was platforming a lot of shock comedians. We saw that Tony Hinchcliffe, who was a roast comic at that Trump rally, which was like, yeah, I got to say, if I was running to be president of the United States, I don't think I'd hire a roast comic to open for me. Like, it probably wasn't the smartest thing to do, but he did it. I mean, you know, because Trump's Trump. He's going to do things like that. You know, you can't, I don't think anyone can probably talk sense into him. He'll do what he does. And he came out recently, this comedian who, you know, was vilified for his jokes on the, on that night, and said, I apologize to no one. I apologize to no one. I'm a comic. What do you want? I'm a comic. These are jokes. You create your opposite. And that's what's happened. Like, all this push for censorship was only ever going to create a pushback. There was no other way around it. There was no way society was just all as one going to get on the same page. And we're just too different for that. We're too diverse for that. Ironically, society's too diverse to make projects like this work, even though they say they're doing it in the name of diversity. And technology, of course, allows people to create new spaces where they can, you know, create content. But even, you know, that being said, we talk about technology and everything, and I know that a lot of the powers that be, you know, have wanted to target technology to sort of slow or really silence some of the voices that they think are a bit, beyond the pale. But we've got to remember the American Revolution began with pamphlets, like the distribution of pamphlets. I mean, imagine what that was like. I want a revolution in this colony, so I'm going to create pamphlets. I don't even know how they did it, and then distribute them. Oh, someone's chasing me now. I got to hide my pamphlets under the house or whatever you did. But that was the internet, the social media of the time. Well, I tell you what, it worked, didn't it?
yeah. And it's also, I mean, everything is so instantaneous today. Yeah. I just want to have a sort of pull on a little through to something that you just said in regards to comedy, because one of the things that you are now seeing comedians, there are two distinct groups. There are the traditional comedians that are the Edinburgh fringe type ones, the mainstream comedians who I personally believe have gotten decidedly unfunny, because there are so many invisible landmines now that they won't go to in the order of not creating offence to a particular protected class or group. And then you've got the roast type comedians, and even comedians like Ricky Gervais, who's gotten to the point where he's famous enough, old enough, long in the tooth and grumpy enough that he just doesn't care. And Dave Chappelle probably falls into that group. You've got Rogan over there. Rob Schneider's another one that sits in that space. One of the things in this country, bringing it back to New Zealand, and you work with this thing, is that some of the funniest people are those that take fun of themselves. And I know you work with a lot of young Polynesian writers and Māori writers. They've always been good. I look at Billy T. James and I think to myself, would Billy T. be able to do his style of comedy in New Zealand today? And sadly, I think no.
Well, he would, but he'd be doing it on Instagram or YouTube, and he wouldn't be making the big dollars, but he'd be, you know, he may have sponsorship, and, you know, I mean, a lot of companies do reach out to these young content makers and you know, influencers and whatever you'd call them, and do support them. Some of them do really well. They do well in Australia, where there's a large Māori diaspora, and they do tours over there. Like, I know people that have done that. The mainstream doesn't even know they exist, but they're international touring artists. It's quite incredible. But the mainstream just doesn't want to really give much attention to. It's like a conspiracy of silence that all these really successful self-made Maori and Polynesian comedians and content makers are out there doing well. But the other thing about politics and comedy, I think it is interesting. I'm not a huge fan of political comedy. I never have been. I think it's very hard to get right. I like Bill Maher, but he has quite traditional jokes. I mean, they might be political, but they're set up in punchline. You know, people always say, oh, that's a dad joke. All a dad joke means is that there's a setup and a punchline. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, you know, long live the dad joke as far as I'm concerned. His writing is in that sort of, maybe not Johnny Carson, but it's in the old style where they're clearly still jokes, right? But I think a lot of comedians lean into politics when they start becoming less funny. When they start becoming less funny and they need to be relevant and have a reason to be on the stage, they'll just rant against politicians and people that they think that their audience doesn't like as well. And that becomes the set. But there aren't a lot of jokes.
I think Howard Stern would fall into that category now, wouldn't he?
I think he probably would fall into that category, unfortunately. Now, he was a guy that was a real shock jock, but he's pulled the ladder up behind him, which is a real shame. But it's hard to be consistently funny. This is a hard business. I wrote 2 seasons of Find Me a Māori Bride. By the time I got into the second season, I wanted to do other things with it. So I was being a bit more abstract and a bit sillier, I guess. The first season was probably a bit more traditional jokes and stuff. But the problem in New Zealand is the budgets are so low. If I was in America, I would have had 10 writers on that. I would have been overseeing it, maybe writing the bulk of it. But if there were any dead patches in my work, there'd be 10 people, each with a joke ready to sort of try to, you know, elbow their way past each other to get on the screen. Amy Schumer, I remember on Facebook years ago looking at when I was writing Māori Bride, her saying, oh, you know, thank you to my writing team. And it was her, obviously, after work drinks, a photograph, and it was her and 15 people. And I thought, what I would do for 15 writers supporting me? How do you screw things up? We don't have that. But I did find that I'd read back what I was writing and think, I'm skidding on ice. I'm skidding on ice here. I've got to get a burst of something. I worked really hard to sort of get through that, but it's tough. And so I think your Raybon Kahns and people like that, I don't want to pick on him, but he's a good example of a person who probably leans into politics a bit more. Michelle Harcourt, they probably lean into that a bit more because they might feel a bit spent creatively, you know, just doing the, when it comes to just pure jokes. I'm not a big fan of political comedy because it's very hard to get right. Because the thing is, you know, you go up there and say Trump sucks or Jacinda Ardern sucks or whoever sucks, you're going to get, you're going to get a response, and we're hungry for that response. And that response, we may think, oh, they like me because I said the right thing. Yeah, but did you say a funny thing? You know, there's a difference, you know. So I do worry about that. Be political. You know, we've got some great political people in the past. Jon Stewart would be in that tradition. I don't always agree with where he goes with some of the stuff, but he is a classic joke teller. Bill Maher is a classic joke teller. Earlier than that, we had Lenny Bruce and people, you know, they stayed funny despite, you know, George Carlin. He's another one. I talked about to someone about this the other day. The worst thing that ever happened to New Zealand comedy was the Herald started giving them columns.
Yeah.
It's just a bad idea. I mean, Michelle Harcourt became a columnist. And so it was all about, oh, my politics, my this, my that. Raybon Kahn became a columnist. He should have found a writer and said, make me a show where I'm the dad and maybe I've got this mixed race family or whatever the story was. He should have been looking to create more of a, develop creative works. A lot of these guys live off corporate gigs now. You know, the end of year telethon, you know, telecom or whatever it's called now, Spark Christmas party. It will give guys like that 10 grand to MC. And they do columns and stuff, but it's not a good place for a comedian to go. It's a graveyard. Mm-hmm. I really believe that. I mean, I think it's a graveyard. I don't want to do it. I mean, I write some political stuff, but you know, like I go through months where I just don't touch any of it because it's like, no, I don't think it's a good use of a comedian's time. I don't think politics, unless you can guarantee you're going to be funny. But you got to test yourself. You got to be so self-reflective and so onto it and tough on yourself. Am I being funny now, or am I just responding to, you know, I said the bad guy's name and you know, got a cheer?
So have these comedians become politically and culturally lazy then?
I think it is that, because like I say, comedy is hard, and you know, anything that's going to make it a little easier. And making money in this business is hard too. So if they're making money through a column or through being on the panel or whatever it is, they're probably going to take that over just sitting down and go, right, I'm going to isolate and write jokes, and I'm going to push myself. I'm going to be a hermit for 6 months, and I'm going to come out with a new set that's just going to blow the socks off people. And I'm 52 now, you know, like, it's, I think they just get a bit fatigued by it because it's hard. It is hard. You know, anyone that, it's like writing a song. It's like, okay, I wrote yesterday. Paul McCartney, people like that are incredible. These guys just wrote amazing songs for like decades. That's rare in a creative life. You normally have 5 to 10 really good years. And then after that, you're sort of self, it's self-parody. You're sort of leaning into stuff that you know you can deliver and do. You're a nostalgic act by that point. People are coming to see you purely because they like some of your old jokes. And you can say them again. I think it is a bit of laziness and just a, but the other thing is, it's, you know, I go back to the whole thing of writing and how I didn't have a lot of support in some of the comedies that I wrote because we just don't have the money and budgets here. But all a Raybon Khan would need to do is go out and get 2 writers, 3 writers and say, let's work on some stuff together. But I just don't think a lot of creatives in New Zealand can fund that. Mm. And that's a real shame. But that's so how they would renew themselves, yeah.
You touched on it the first time we spoke, and you've touched on it again. One of the things I'm noticing is a lot of the pillars of traditional, whether it be news media or comedy or drama or film, are now on the decline, significantly on the decline, and new alternative forms of consuming media are starting to come to the fore. So whether that be social media, TikTok, Instagram, even X if you're a news type creator, is that the new exciting frontier now of comedy and writing?
I think it is. I mean, my eyes were opened when I first started working with a lot of the Maori and Polynesian content creators out south. They can do a 30-second clip. It was very observational. It was, you know, like there were little skits like stealing money from your dad to buy lollies up the road and you know, but done with charm and you know, fun. And they were, you know, taking the piss out of their parents and how their parents spoke. And, you know, it was very observational. So, but that's all, yeah, Instagram and stuff like that. It's hard to know where it's going to go, though, because, I mean, Joe Rogan, to me, is a fascinating case study. Because before Joe Rogan and someone like Jordan Peterson, if you told someone that young men were going to sit down and listen to a academic speak about Carl Jung or Jungian type theories with a guy like Joe Rogan for 3 hours, people would say, oh, that's ridiculous. No one has the attention spans anymore. It's the internet age. If it, 10 seconds, if they're not grabbed, they're out. That proved to be completely not true, because we have a lot of young men now sitting down and watching 3.5 hour podcasts of a guy talking. Who would have known? So we can't really predict where this is going to go. I mean, all we can do is create, exploit the technology for all it's worth, and see what we stumble upon. It is the future, clearly. I mean, everything linear is in decline. But what that's going to look like, I couldn't pretend to know.
Mm. Well, here in this country too, I do worry because, I mean, as you said, there isn't the money there. We're seeing media being squeezed dramatically right now. And it will be interesting to see where all of that, what washes out. And I look at, you know, when we've got children of a similar age. So I look at my son's friends and banter. There's something about boy banter.
Yeah.
Being a mother, the hardest thing, of course, is when you hear boy banter is not to put your big grumpy mama bear on, but you have to just let it go. And they have a tendency to be able to work stuff out themselves. But there is some of it is also incredibly genuinely funny.
Yeah.
And they don't, I don't think they realize that they're being quite so funny, but they laugh and they josh and they have all of this joy. They love absurdist humor. I mean, yeah. I catch them watching Python. Mm. They love Monty Python.
Mm.
And you'd struggle to get some Python out now. People, you know, there would be certain circles that would throw their hands up in air and horror and want to cancel you for such things.
Yeah, the whole male thing that, you know, and even with young men, they're sparring, basically.
Mm.
They're in a ring and they're just having jabs and they're looking for weaknesses and all that kind of thing. you know, men can do that. Men can be brutal to each other, but it's done with a lot of love.
Yeah.
And I think that's the other thing people don't get about even racist jokes. No, this is going to be a bit controversial, but I'll say it anyway. I was at a, I don't know, I may have told you this story last time, working in South Auckland on a lot of labouring gangs. They were really multicultural gangs. And when I came in, I was a glam rocker at the time. I was into Guns N' Roses and getting drunk on a Friday night and Saturday night and going over to the North Shore to find all the shore girls and, you know, all of that stuff. But I had long blonde hair and, you know, they used to call me the Weller woman. You remember?
Yeah.
So I was the Weller woman and I got completely harassed and, you know, and I can't repeat the things they'd say to me. You know, there was Samoans, there was Indian. I mean, some of the Indian guys got such a hard time, but they laughed. They, you know, they'd laugh and everything. But it was clear that the group was testing each other to see who didn't have a great sense of humor. The person that couldn't take it didn't last long in those gangs because we had to work with these people all the time. Can you take a joke? Our jobs were pretty dirty. We were covered in filth, digging holes all day, all that kind of thing. But we were laughing all day. We were shocking each other. We were seeing if we could, you know, one-up each other the whole time. Even though some of those jokes to, you know, would, you know, turn an inner city green supporter's hair white, for us, they were delivered in love. They really were delivered in love. It's a very male thing, I think. But that, see, that goes into the whole, a lot of people that cancel jokes and they don't really understand humor. You know, if they did, they wouldn't, they'd know. Or maybe they do, and but they want to score points or something. I don't know. No, it's so vital. It's so vital for, I mean, especially in a multicultural area like the one I was brought up in. I mean, it was the lubricant that kept the cogs turning, really. Your humor. I mean, it's the funnier. I've never laughed more than I ever have when I was in South Auckland. For that reason, because it was so, humor was so key to making diversity work. But no, we don't want to put walls up between each other because then you lose that. And you're probably going to get a lot more tension, if any.
So in terms of projects now, what do you see as hopeful on the horizon in terms of sort of comedy or creativity within the New Zealand sphere? There's got to be something that's sort of chipping around the edges that may need to get a little bit more of a spotlight on it.
I don't know. I mean, the interesting thing, like for me personally, is that I've been doing a lot of podcasts recently and narrative podcasts. I haven't worked in TV that much. I used to work, it was my bread and butter exclusively. If I didn't have TV, I wouldn't have been making any money. But I'm making a living not working in TV. And that sort of crept up on me. Like I've been able to sort of break away from TV and the space I'm in now. I'm not saying I wouldn't go back, but the space I'm in now, the audio space is I've found very interesting because you don't really have the overheads of TV. Like TV is a very expensive paint box. You need, for the lowest budget comedy that I made, I needed $1 million or $700,000 or $800,000 or something, like a house in a relatively good area, you know, like to make my comedies. And that was NZ On Air handing that money out, right?
Mm-hmm.
With a podcast, I can make something easily as creative for $100,000 or $150,000, and I make the same amount of money, which is interesting because I'm not hiring lighting trucks. I'm not hiring 21 crew members, 22 crew members. The overheads just aren't there. And you can get a lot more creative with audio in that audio space because, I mean, I could sit it on a spaceship. What do I need? I just need beep. Beep, beep, I just need the sound effect and I'm there. I didn't have to build a set or anything like that. That's going to open up a whole new, new genres that we haven't been able to sort of fund in the past and things like that. The other thing, just in answering your question, Bill Burr was on a podcast. He said something really interesting, I thought, about the internet and work that is more niche, which is the way we're going now. And that is that if I want to be a big star, right? Like, say, Warner Brothers pick me up. I'm in a few of their films. I sign contracts. I'm the big deal. You know, I've made it. I'm making really good money, but I'm completely owned. They own my films. I don't own anything, just the money. And unless I'm a producer on it as well, I may own a share of it, but I don't really own anything, but I'm getting a lot of money. I'd probably be better off if I, and say I had 1 million Instagram followers or 1.5 million followers. So I'm a big deal, right? I'd probably make more money if I had 30,000 followers, but those followers were so passionate about what I did that they'd buy, that like 70% of them would buy my t-shirts, my new CDs, any funding drive I wanted to do, they supported me. I would be the boss. I would be answerable to no one but myself. What would be the better life? Like the better creative life, I would say, would probably be opting for the 30,000 passionate followers in your own corner of the internet than being a big deal star in Hollywood films with contracts with Warner Brothers and so forth. I found that really interesting. That's probably the direction of where we're going. Now with news, I actually understand the argument that if we don't have some sort of centralized news services, then we are going to really spiral in terms of we're going to be, not a lot's going to link us together. And that could be a concern. But again, who's making the news? Who's sort of making the centralized service? I don't have an answer to that. I'm not going to pretend I have an answer to that. What will link us? Maybe it's culture. Maybe it's music. Maybe music needs to go through a renaissance. And we link that way. We're all listening to getting news from different sources, but we're brought together by culture or an external force like a war. I mean, that might be the unifier. I think we're going to look for unifiers. The more fragmented we get, the more we are going to yearn to be one as a country at the same time. I don't think it's enough for us just to, that's what America has done so well for so long. They own their diversity. They celebrate their diversity. But Americanism is a creed. Free speech is a part of that. You know, there are all sorts of, you know, the whole freedom thing, which, you know, people here often take the piss out of, but it's very important, you know, like it does. These are positive principles and values that link them. We need that. We don't really have that.
I think in New Zealand, actually culturally too, we've lost that number eight wire robustness that we once had.
Yeah.
We've become sort of coddled a little bit and we fall back into safetyism, and there's been, and often we will look to Wellington for answers when actually we need to look within ourselves, don't we? And we need to create our own connections. And I fully agree with you in regards to, I mean, I look at what we've done with Reality Check Radio and these conversations that we have. I mean, essentially, we're a series of podcasts masquerading as a radio station. Yeah. And people, and we've seen with the numbers that we've got, people are engaging in that content and they're listening to those conversations. And I think you're right. And we've certainly learned that we're better off to have, you know, a smaller number, not that it's small, it's surprisingly large, the number of downloads, highly engaged listeners, than we are to have a whole bunch of accidental ones. So, yeah.
100%. On the number eight wire thing, I think it's quite a rural sensibility, you know. We were a lot more connected to rural New Zealand in, you know, Fred Dagg and even Billy T. There were lots of representations of rural life. We don't have that as much anymore. And pitching for TV, as I have done for years now, I did notice that if I took a rural idea to them, they weren't keen. They wanted inner city ideas. And so we sort of lost, I think, the creative, you know, the representation of the provinces in a lot of creative work was marginalized at some point, where the powers that be decided they didn't want to reflect that. They thought the real audiences were in Auckland and Wellington, maybe Christchurch, and you know, we don't have to serve Palmerston North. But some of these smaller stories and more rural stories are still representative of who we really are ethically, I think. Mm. You'd lose that. Like, if you get the numbers, like I get the NZ On Air numbers every week or 2 weeks, and they say, these are the top 10 shows on linear TV.
I know where you're going with this.
When I started 25 years ago,
mm-hmm.
number one was Country Calendar.
And it's still number one.
It's still number one. Now, yeah. I just want your viewers to understand this. When I say number one, I'm talking 300,000, you know, sets of eyes on this thing. And then that'll be number one. And then in, say it's a top 10, that's number one. Number 10 could be Q&A with 90,000.
Mm. Yep.
It doesn't really rate that well.
See, you're a boy from South Auckland. See, I grew up in the most rural part of the Raukumara Ranges. So I come from the complete opposite from where you grew up. You know, I literally grew up in BF nowhere, you know. So, and there's this rural, like there is this rural ruggedness that still exists today in this country. And even if the farmer has gone to town or their families have gone to town, there is still very much a rural ruggedness. And it may not necessarily be from a farm perspective, but you go to places like Central Otago, you still see that in those that work in outdoor industries or horticulture or farming or fishing or still a local Māori choosing to live in their ancestral lands. You know, there is a sense of community and a fabric and a connection in those rural spaces that when you're living, what is it now, a third of New Zealand's population or getting close to at least a quarter living in one city, you sort of forget. You forget that there's all these lovely, beautiful little regional nuances out there. And it's and Country Calendar, the fact that they can still, after, 30, 40 years, still be telling New Zealand stories about New Zealanders on the land in one form or another and still be capturing those audiences, I think is a testament to the people that they're telling the stories about.
Oh, 100%. But, you know, Māori TV, I don't know how many of your, I mean, you know, the numbers aren't great for Māori TV. They've never been fantastic for Māori TV. But they have a lot of those stories. You know, they are in the provinces. They are talking to a lot of people that have, you know, with different projects going on there and everything. It's a lot more connected to the average New Zealander, I think. But, you know, South Auckland also is a marginalised community. We've never had a lot of money thrown at our creatives. Again, it's like that inner city thing. It's because I think the decision makers are reflecting their own experience. You know, they come from the inner city. They go to certain bars. So let's make a slick sort of TV show about a strip bar and a guy who's a woman who's a lawyer and now she works at the strip bar and she's the boss and it's a feminist thing and it just doesn't reach Joe Schmo, you know, it doesn't reach the South Aucklander, it doesn't reach the rural TV watcher. It's a very small clique of people, you know, that they're sort of making content for, and their numbers are low accordingly. You know,
and what they need to realise is that one of the, what I think it probably still is, the greatest dramatic hit in television in recent times in this country was actually someone telling a story like that, which was Outrageous Fortune.
Yeah.
You know, that Western Auckland story. So it just sort of goes to show that those
very
stories
have power. Sanitised West Auckland story, I got to say. Like the Westies, when I was a kid, the Westies would freak me out. Because that's what big bikers were and guys with huge beards and leather jackets. And, yeah, they were, some of those guys were pretty scary. We'd go out to parties every now and again and think,
Well, I'm just looking at the time. We better wrap this up. Now, people are wanting to engage with some of your work or writing. Where can they find that, Dane? Are you still doing work with Plainside?
We've sort of put it on ice for a little bit just because I got so busy. Like I was running I started my own company since I spoke to you last and have been producing stuff myself. And as a producer, as well as a writer and everything, boy, oh boy, you know, you do not have a spare. It's like small business owner, you know, you just, you know, it's like, oh, I want to be the boss, but you don't have a spare moment in your day. You know, it's just the way it is. But I've done a couple of podcasts this year. I've had a really good year, actually, in terms of like content. And so I just did one on Daniela Smith, who was our first female boxing world champion. and it's a, and I collaborated with her and told her story. That's on RNZ, actually, and Uncut Diamond Daniela. And she really talks about, she's got an interesting story where she sort of got to the top of the game and that became her darkest moment. So that's one to find. It's a really good personal story of this Wahine warrior who conquered the world, really, and not enough people know about her. And another boxing podcast, actually, called The Canvas, which is on Rover with MediaWorks, which we released in May of this year, as it looks at different stories, at different boxes over 8 episodes. And that's narrated by John Tuohy, who was in Fast and the Furious and all sorts. So that one's out. So those two are the big ones. I've got development going on and things. I can't talk much about them, but there's two great shows that you can go and listen to if you want to.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for this. It's always been good to catch up. We can't leave it too long next time.
Yeah, no, definitely. And of course, free speech is what brought me here. So guys, check out the Free Speech Union on Twitter, on Facebook, get involved. You know, we're always looking for your feedback and for, you know, and we need your support. We are the ultimate grassroots organization. So do support us.
Lovely. Hey, look, Dane, it's been an absolute joy. This has been Dane Giroux, as you said, writer-producer on the board of the Free Speech Union, and check out those podcasts that he's got produced. We'll make sure we have those in the show notes so you can access them. And don't disappear. If you've got any feedback for us, 2057 is the text number, inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email, and I'll be back shortly. Thanks, Dane.
Thank you.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.